Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host today is Dave Allen, as we bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. It is Friday, May 1st, 2020. Good afternoon, Dave.
TGIF, Melody.
I don't know what's going on, but I'll tell you what. I kind of do look forward to Friday nights anymore. I usually close down a little earlier on Fridays. You get to the point, we've had such a, it was a tough, we got caught up, everything is caught up, and everything is pretty much back to normal prior to the 10,000 point drop in the stock market. And so it's thanks for the TGIF, and don't have any special plans this weekend.
Yeah.
Other than, yes, I'm one of those that I get to do little projects around the house that that they normally don't get done. So, work. Anyway, let's see what gold has done today. I've been...
Not bad, considering where it was this morning.
And we had some ups and some downs. We have the Dow up... we had the gold up 1580. 1580... for gold at 1701.90. Silver was down 2 pennies at 1501. Platinum was down 10 at 763. Palladium was down 58 points at 1986. 10-year yield 99.03. Crude oil was up 93 cents. That's 19.77. And, you know, I got some couple of good reports on oil. I don't know how much we're going to talk about it today, Dave, but there are some reports I wanted to go over. And the paper markets today, they went down, you know, 500-600 points, and they just stayed there most of the day. Dow down 617 points, a little over 2.5%, 23,728. NASDAQ was down almost... 3.25, 284 points at 8,604. The S&P was almost 3%, down 81, 2,830. 10-year yield, 0.64%, still in that trading range. Japan was down almost 3%. Germany was down 2.25. London was down 2.25, so they were all down overnight. You did have Hong Kong, they were barely up at 67 points. And, you know, we're just cruising right along. The fear and greed index, we've been at this 40 number, 42, 43 number for, it's been a while. Came off that big low when the market was dropped 10,000 points, and the fear and greed index, the emotion is between fear and neutral at 43, with 50 being neutral. So that's where we're there today. And I didn't know, Dave, where we wanted to start off, unless you wanted me to just go over a couple of the reports that I wanted to talk about. Wait, let's touch on the U.S. manufacturing, because that kind of ties in. That continued to intensify in April to its worst level in 11 years. The ISM manufacturing index fell to 41.5. And it was down nearly 20% for March's 49.1. Now, this measure, dispersion gauge, measuring the percentage of firms seeing expansion, and, of course, any reading below 50, of course, indicates a contraction. So while just about every category showed sharp declines, the overall index was held higher by the inventories. That showed a reading of 49.7 up to 2.8% from March. New orders were at 27.1. That was down 15 points. Production fell to 27.5 off 20 points from the month earlier, Dave.
Yeah, the employment index slid to 27.5. That was a decline of over 16 percentage points and reflected more than 30 million claims, 30.3 for unemployment benefits over the past 6 weeks. And as we'll be talking about later on today's program, that could actually pale in comparison to the actual number of people unemployed that haven't been getting picked up. The price index also fell dropping 2 points to 35. There's also a separate piece of news that was actually slightly better than expectations. Construction spending actually rose 0.9% in March, beating estimates of a 3% decline. On the manufacturing side, though, the mood was definitely downbeat. Comments from respondents to the ISM survey indicated a strong negative sentiment about their prospects. Not surprised there. One respondent in a manufacturing industry said, COVID-19 has destroyed our market and our company. Without a full recovery very soon and some assistance, I fear our ability to continue operations. Melody.
Well, you know, the big story, I think, has been a lot about the oil. The oil rigs are cutting. Yeah, they're cutting oil rigs for a seventh week in a row as we see these major producers slam the brakes on the shale oil production. And it's coming at a time when the crude oil prices and fuel demand, you know, of course, have plunged due to the global lockdowns. Yeah, and it was beginning to slow up anyway, so let's not forget that. Mm-hmm. You know, China was slowing down quite a bit. So, yes, it was the... The virus might have had the final pinch to the balloon, but the balloon was already pricked. you have drillers cut 53 oil rigs in the week to May 1st, bringing the total count down to 325. Now, this goes back to the lowest since of June 2016.
Wow.
The oil rig count, an early indicator of future output, is down 60% from a year ago. I think a year ago they had a little over 800 oil rigs that were active. More than half of the total U.S. oil rigs are in the Permian Basin in West Texas and eastern New Mexico, where active units dropped by 27 this week to 219. And the total number of oil and gas rigs active in the United States was down 57 to 408 this week. And that's just above the all-time low. Again, going back to 2016, a 404, and this data goes back by Baker Hughes to 1940.
Wow.
Yeah. So, analysts at Raymond James projected total U.S. oil and natural gas rigs would collapse from around 800 at the end of 2019 to a record low of around 400 by the middle of the year and around 200 at the end of the year.
Well, we had read reported, I think it was earlier this week, could have been last week, when prices were even more volatile on the downside, that when there was talk of widespread closing down of rigs on land, that there was a big concern among the owners of those companies, because apparently once a rig is shut down, it's extremely hard to be brought back up again, and then especially to operate effectively. So that certainly is a potential issue going ahead here. Now, we're also seeing that the ExxonMobil and Chevron are talking about deep cuts in output and their investments in the Permian Shale Basin. That, of course, is the top U.S. Oil field. It's the basin where growth, in fact, in recent years has made America the world's top oil producer and a net exporter for the first time in many decades. ConocoPhillips, the world's largest independent oil and gas producer, plans to accelerate output cuts by 40,000 barrels a day in May and bring its reduction in North America by the end of June to 460,000 barrels a day. That's the largest cut by any producers here. So,
well, you know, what's interesting about Wells Fargo, they have a large book of loans from the oil industry, and they have revived its special group for bad energy loans in recent weeks as the bank is bracing from the sharp downturn in these oil prices. Sitting inside the credit resolution group where Wells Fargo handles struggling borrowers, the team includes many bankers who previously worked with the same oil and gas producers in its investment bank. So they work alongside bankruptcy specialists who have been reassigned to focus exclusively on energy and to help Wells Fargo wade through the expected flood of restructurings. It's a bloodbath, said one person with the knowledge of the bank's oil and gas portfolio. Bankruptcies have begun with an April 7 survey of producers by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City forecasting 40% would be insolvent within a year if oil prices were $30 per barrel. So we've seen that this is nearly double the current value.
Wow.
So, you know, they have... And I think the other large, bank is J.P. Morgan. So they're studying on how they would take ownership of energy assets if borrowers proved unable to repay their debts to the banks. And some are actually preparing to set up legal entities which would own stakes in these seized properties. So Wells Fargo is instead hoping to capitalize of its internal resources, but can you believe that? They're studying how they're going to take ownership.
Just what Americans need for their banking industry.
Yeah.
Ownership of, it's right now very risky business.
Yes. And then I think we talked about it the other day, how Wells Fargo, the largest U.S. mortgage lender, well, they said this yesterday, is temporarily stopping accepting applications for home equity loans.
Yeah.
The suspension will stay in place until bank executives have better sense into what the economic recovery will look like. Banks have been making moves to tighten credit quality in response to the virus. You know, it always cracks me up. Here are your banks. They're getting their they're getting buku bucks coming in from the government, and yet they're tightening up their, you know, they don't, you know, let the people suffer, and we're not going to make any loans to them and so forth, but, you know, just keep giving us, so keep bailing us out. And J.P. Morgan Chase is also the largest U.S. bank by assets, have also raised its mortgage borrowing standards and temporarily also stopped accepting new applications for home equity lines of credit. And they did that in April 17th, so... A little bit sooner than Wells Fargo, so that kind of tied into what we were talking about on the oil, and Wells Fargo is preparing. They set up their own, their little group in order to, fight these places to for bankruptcy. But
it's an outrage that Wells Fargo is still in business.
It is. It is.
Any number of them, you can argue, should have been... either allowed to fail or at a minimum be broken up after the bailouts of a decade ago. But Wells Fargo in particular, with evidence upon evidence of continuing, I won't even call it mismanagement, it's malmanagement. It shouldn't be allowed, and the Fed has really fallen down, as have the banking regulators, in my estimation.
You know, when they did it for Bank of America, I mean, that's another one. Look at Deutsche Bank.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all teetering. And you're right. It's just they shouldn't be in business.
You know, they see that these banks see that more borrowers are delaying paying their mortgage payments.
Yeah.
I mean, they're taking advantage of the government's bailout program. They're allowed to do this, I think, for up to a year. I mean, we can jump down to that. To that piece of news. And I got to believe that the underwriters at Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase and others, have just made a calculated bet that they're not going to add additional risk or take the chance of additional write-offs on their balance sheet. again, from people who aren't able to afford, repaying their mortgages or other lines of credit at this time.
Now they'd rather snag the businesses of the oil companies.
Yeah, right.
There's profit there, not in homes that they have to carry on their books, you know, empty.
I know. It really, you know, they're talking about these monthly mortgage payment delays growing at a rate of half a million a week. As of yesterday, almost 4 million homeowners were in forbearance plans, about 7.5% of all active mortgages. And I suspect it's higher than that. Together, they account for $841 billion, Melody, in unpaid principal, make up over 6% of all loans from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, over 10% of all FHA VA loans. Now, again, the government's program, which was part of the CARES Act, signed into law late in March, we're now in May, allows borrowers to delay up to a year's worth of payments. They have to be made up later, either through repayment plans with their mortgage holder or actual modifications to their mortgage. So,
you know, Dave, this story hasn't been played out. It's just beginning as far as, you know, what really does happen and so forth. And yeah, my heart goes out to these folks because, you know, we all want a roof over our head. But you know what? During through the 2008, yeah, people made bad decisions just like they have today. They've gone into homes that they can't or shouldn't afford if they have a bad day. Just in 2008, the people couldn't, they lost their jobs by no fault of their own. And where was all the government money then? They didn't have forbearance programs back then. You know, they couldn't make up payments later or repay or make mortgage modifications.
Yeah, and they were too busy bailing out the...
Yeah. But, I mean, the point is it all comes from taxpayers' dollars.
Right.
And, you know, I think if people should be helped, I think it should be from within the state. Let the states help the people.
Problem with that, though, the states don't have the excesses. I mean, if you said it would have be up to the states, no one would get it.
The states
can't print money.
but the problem is from how many years ago. We everybody knows there's always a real estate crash sooner or later.
Sure.
Prices gets. I mean, it's just a natural thing. People get these adjustable rate mortgages. Well, we always know what happens to them. The rates go up. People lose their job, and then you have a bunch of people that had adjustable rate mortgages. You know, well, it's life.
File bankruptcy.
Life happens. We'll be right back because breaks happen also. And we'll be right back right after a few short messages.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Make sure you visit the website. And I'm looking something up here while I'm talking, so if you can't figure that one out, make sure you visit our website at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com, and sign up for our weekly newsletter. And in this newsletter, I think one of the things, too, that I tried to explain as we were going through the month of March and April when everything is hitting is the spreads between New York futures and the London spot gold price and how it affects them, how it started, and, you know, the big spreads. And I know most of you follow Kitco. Well, in the industry does not use Kitco, all right? It doesn't use any website that posts signs or prices that are going over the top of their websites. The industry doesn't use those. Okay, we usually use wholesalers. We'll be using either the New York futures, London spot gold, and so it was an interesting article, and you'll find that in the newsletter this weekend. It talks a little bit about the bullion banks, how they often have a long spot position in London, and how that all works. So it's kind of interesting, and it has some graphs. We'll try to get those in there for you. So make sure you sign up at the news at the website at dgscoins.com, and then we'll also have the market report updated, and of course Dave's article in there along with Wendy Wilson. So, you know, we're talking about the economy. We saw manufacturing has just taken a, and we don't even manufacture that much, but it's slumped to the worst level in 11 years. And we've talked about what's happening to department stores. You know all about Macy's. You know all about these department stores that are anchoring America's malls. More than 50% of these department stores are going to close permanently by the end of next year. And this was a new report from Green Street Advisors. That's amazing. There are about 1,000 malls still open in the U.S., and roughly 60% of those have department store retailers such as Macy's as anchor tenants. You have the coronavirus pandemic. It's shut everything down. It forced the likes of Penny's, Macy's, Nordstrom's, Neiman Marcus to shut shops temporarily. Slumping sales. You have an overhang of debt. You know, they're going to go, some of them are going to go into bankruptcy. They're all strained for cash. So more department store closures are inevitable. And again, that's just going to put another level of pressure on these mall owners. Dave.
One likely scenario, Melody, we're seeing play out at malls is that some of the inline tenants like Gap or Victoria's Secret going to use their co-tenancy clauses to speak up as department stores go dark. That means these clauses give companies the ability to demand things like rent relief or to break leases early when the anchor space sits vacant. That pressure could be what actually put some of the malls entirely out of business. Penny's said more than 850 stores makes up about 19% of mall anchor space. Macy's at 18%. Then you have others like Nordstrom, Dillard's, Lord & Taylor combined make up another 20%. Things are not looking good in retail. We've been talking about this regularly over the past 2 years under the title of Retail Apocalypse, and it certainly is living up to its name, isn't it, Melody?
It is. It is. But this is all been, this isn't just because of the virus. This has all been happening way before that the virus struck.
Yeah, this is just the last dagger.
It's the last dagger, and it will be, it was the biggest and the most memorable, so it will be the one that they tag everything to. Because no one will take, no one wants to take claim to, no one wants to take claim to it. So, just like even the Great Recession of 2008, they didn't want to blame anybody. So it was all the bad subprime lenders. It was all their fault.
Wow, you think about it, coming full circle for us, baby boomers. This is the end of a way, the end of an important part of our generation's culture, others as well. But when we were just coming of age, junior high school is when, you know, our downtowns were being moved to the edge of town with these malls, and it was our hangout for 3, 4, 5, even 6 years through our high school days. Our kids' generation years later, but to a far less extent. It's been on a gradual downward spiral since at least the 90s. And here we are, just possibly 1 year away from the demise of the Great Mall.
I'll tell you, and then what are they going to do with all these buildings?
Well,
I always say they should convert them into apartments and, you know,
one
affordable
could only
housing.
Hope. That's actually happening to a regional mall about 15 miles
really?
From where I live. Probably, by now it's probably, and it's a fairly large indoor mall. I'd say a quarter of it right now has been converted to a hospital system's one of their what do they call them? I forget what they call them now, but a part of it's an urgent care center, and then doctors, specialist offices, and they're talking about taking up at least another quarter of the space, and right behind it, and it can be attached, and I'm sure it will be if that's the direction this one goes. There must be, oh my gosh, there must be at least 4, maybe 5 fairly large, I bet you they're 2,500, maybe 3,000 apartment units in this town of roughly 30,000. So it's adding, or has the capacity to add another 10% pretty quickly. I don't know where all these people are going to come from, where they're, you know, who's going to live there, actually. But
interesting.
We see it already taking hold some places.
Yeah, they're not going to bulldoze them over. So I can't imagine they did that, did they? They didn't bulldoze
no,
it over. Yeah.
No, not at all right now. Sears was one of the anchor tenants. They're gone. That's vacant. Nordstrom is another one. That's everything else is the big ones are still open, including Macy's, but a lot of the smaller, as they call them, the in-store tenants are starting to close down one after the other. They have rebuilt part of it with a Whole Foods, store. So it's fascinating to see this transition.
Excuse me. I did a lot of talking this week, and I think my voice is telling me after this program you need to wind down, girl. But anyway, you know, you wanted to talk about, you know, gold has had its best month in 4 years, and yesterday it's the end of the month. And, of course, there's, you know, the expectations of more monetary easing from the Fed that we talk about here every single day, along with other central banks and the global recession. The 10,000 point drop in the Dow and all the other ones, the large percentages, even though they came back, 30%? I mean, it's that makes people wake up. Temporarily, but they did wake up. New York spot gold prices rose about 7% in April and is up over 11% year to date. And of course, the stimulus from the Fed. I mean, we're almost at number 4. And lower interest rates reduce the opportunity cost of holding non-yielding gold. So it also benefits from widespread stimulus measures and is often seen as a hedge against inflation. Currency debasement. This is all the things that we've talked about, and now they're writing about it and bringing it to people's attention. Chief analyst, Active Trades, Carlo De Casa, he said, from a technical point of view, a clear climb above the resistance placed at 1730, 1735 is going to create space for further rallies in gold. And Dave, I'm just a firm believer. The rally in gold is our fiat currency, but this does bring it to today's happenings. But I wanted to ask you this too, not to go off topic here. I listened to just part of a Paul Krugman interview this morning.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that or not.
I did.
I thought it was interesting, and oh, had I wished I'd been there to ask him this question. He talked about the amount of debt that government can carry. And he says even various times with Japan having 200% of GDP and even the U.S. carrying, 150% of GDP through the war in various points in time throughout history and so forth, it worked when there was a low interest rate. And he says mainly the government can whittle that debt down if the rates are low. He says they've done it in the past. My question is, but in the past, they didn't need a continuing stimulus. I mean, usually the stimulus that they used or the debt was for a period of time. And then they would go through some sort of accountability, maybe small. But then it allowed them to deliver it or to lower. In today's world, they can't stop. Am I making sense? I mean,
absolutely.
So is that, and he seemed to think, well, you know, they, our government, you know, and I thought, no, he's wrong.
Well,
there is a day of reckoning for this. They can't continue it to the level that they are, and they have to keep it going.
I think I see where he was coming from. And I think he only told a little part of the story. I mean, the one critical advantage, I'll say, possibly the only advantage now, relatively speaking, with this incredibly unsustainable level of debt we have in this country, across the world, for that matter, but. Is these low interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only a function of the amount of interest on the debt that the government has to pay the owners of our treasury bonds, well, and other government agency bonds. So, you know, in that respect, it's given everything that's going on now, it's been a lot easier for government to engage fiscal policy because interest rates are so low. that the sentiment must be, although not many of them talk about this publicly, but the sentiment must be that, well, the incremental cost of additional debt is so low because interest rates are, you know, 1%, give or take. Actually, they're less, but so it doesn't matter as much. But you're absolutely right. The other, I don't even say the other half, the other 75% of the equation is just the sheer amount. I mean, the Mount Everest level of governmental debt. We're talking about just the federal government. I mean, we're not even talking about state and local governments. We're not even talking about pension, unfunded pension liabilities. And that's where it comes home to roost, because even at roughly 0% interest rates, we're still not going to pay down any of our debt. We're not going to see whether it's 1 year from now or 10 years from now. I mean, borrowing some miraculous, like, new currency or new concept that you can only dream of. I mean, and at this point in history, in this country anyway, there's more and more talk of modern monetary theory, MMT, and all that. I mean, largely that entails more and more operating deficits, rising national debt. And it is. MMT, if interest rates should go high, and I honestly, I guess I'm not predicting because I don't do that or try not to, but I see more and more the likelihood of some kind of universal basic income being implemented during this pandemic to get individuals anyway through the roughest of times. And I mean again, it's a slippery slope. I don't think in general we're ready for something like that, if we ever would be. As a philosophy, we'd ever want to be. I mean, it's totally transformational. I mean, talk about paradigm shift. I mean, it's like, shake your head and think, where am I? But only that can only happen in an era of low interest rates. So it makes me wonder.
Yeah, but aren't these interest rates just going to eventually climb on their own?
Theoretically, they ought to.
Yeah, because,
and,
I mean, eventually...
Sooner than later.
That's going to be the attraction for buying the debt, right? Or is just everybody else is just in the same boat? They're just sustaining each other and doing what the other one's doing just to keep it going.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
It's talk about a vicious cycle. Just the blades are getting sharper, ladies and gentlemen.
And we do have a break, and that's also a cycle every 20 minutes. We'll be right back, folks. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom. Today is May 1st, 2020. I'm here with my co-host, Dave Allen. We're talking about the rates, the Fed keeping interest rates near zero just to keep everything going. But the day of reckoning of everything has got to, and we should eventually see these rates rise, as Dave had said. So moving along, Kudlow. My BFF, Larry Kudlow, National Economic Council Director, he said this morning that the United States would hold China accountable for this pandemic. On the China business, it's up in the air. They're going to be held accountable for it. Now, how does the National Economic Council Director say that China is going to be held accountable? I mean, where does he get off in saying that? But I've heard it. From President
Trump.
Yeah,
they're talking. Yeah, I mean, he's going down the road of tariffs and sanctions and, oh, geez.
But you know what was interesting? I heard someone, I don't know who it was, it was just, you know, something I heard in the passing. And they say, you notice when they are talking about this, now, you know, back in January, President Trump said that President Xi was a good friend, a good guy, whatever. But as they talk about this pandemic, the virus coming from a Chinese lab, and that they might impose tariffs, and all this talk, you notice he doesn't mention President Xi's name. It's always China. China, China, China. They never specifically point to him as the president. And that is, I think that's interesting.
Very astute observation, too.
Mm-hmm. And I started reading these articles, and it's like, yeah. And so I'm thinking China's going to find some poor scapegoat. But they're going to blame, and Lord knows what will happen to them. But
it was Kim Jong-un.
Maybe. Yes.
He's been taken out.
Yes. Well, you know, we haven't heard anything more about him either. So, and that's, it's getting a little bit longer with as much pressure on everyone trying to say whether he is or whether he isn't alive. But hey, if they wanted to take him out, you know. But look what the Russians did to the person in London, England.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The daughter survived. It was some sort of a poison. So, I mean, there's a lot of ways. And look what Kim Jong-un even did to his own family through poisons and so forth. But anyway, that's speculating there. And that's... But
no.
Kudlow...
No, I was just going to say, one can only hope that we have a Kerry Matheson and a Saul Berenson at our... at our disposal. Yeah. My favorite television characters.
Well, you know, Kudlow said that it would be Trump's decision if he wanted to add more tariffs with respect to future tariff decisions and other measures. That's not going to help our economy if we put tariffs on China. It's not going to help us at all. The U.S. has already imposed tariffs on Chinese imports, of course, the trade deal. And I don't know if there's anything else interesting in that, Dave.
Well, the one thing that he brought up unsolicited, which makes you wonder, is that, you know, he took the initiative to deny these reports that are out there that the White House was considering refusing to pay government debt held by China.
Yeah.
You know, as a form of retaliation. You know, and then in the same breath, he says, well, the full faith and credit of the U.S. debt is sacrosanct. I mean, it's good to hear him say that on the one hand. You know,
it's not any different than when the reports are that President Trump had made the threat to the Saudis in the first part of April.
Yeah.
That if you don't cut production, we're going to pull our military.
Yeah.
And, of course, if you think, like I said, well, yeah, that would destroy the petrodollar. You want to see our dollar tank fast? But if these threats are real, they come back and bite. Because they have things that they can threaten us with, too. So... I think it's a dangerous game, but maybe this game is played more often than what we...
Jeez.
Yeah. Travel, if you're going to be traveling, air travel.
This is pretty amazing.
We have the passenger traffic down 95%. Airlines have pretty much given up on trying to salvage their lucrative summer travel season. The global industry expects to lose $314 billion this year. You have airline executives saying that could be 2 to 3 years before air travel recovers to pre-crisis levels. In the meantime, pack your patience along with your face mask because everything's going to take longer. Expect new procedures from luggage check-in to security clearance and boarding. You might even need to have your blood tested.
Sick.
I wouldn't fly anymore. No. If my passport isn't good enough, Airline consultant Shashank Nijam. He's a CEO, and I'm sure I crucified that. But,
hey, that looks good to me.
I was almost going to say Shashank.
That's the first thing I thought of, too.
CEO of Simplifying said 9/11 changed travel completely. Of course, we saw the security checks, longer check-in times, and this is even going to be with the virus even more far-reaching. And it's just a matter of how much hassle will people tolerate, or are they going to avoid flying altogether, Dave?
Well, here are some of the things we're reading that they're considering. I mean, we know that a couple of the airlines are already... going to require passengers to wear face masks along with their staff. Others say they'll make them available to passengers. Of course, their flight crews are already wearing them on the few flights that are still taking place. Some say they'll limit ticket sales so that middle seats can remain open. Simplifying, a company that Melody just mentioned, they anticipate a number of changes in the coming months and years, like at online check-in. Passengers will need to upload a document to confirm the presence of COVID-19 antibodies before they're allowed on the plane. Airport curbside, passengers could be required to arrive at least 4 hours.
Oh, my Lord.
Their flight, and then pass through a disinfection tunnel or thermal scanner to check their body temperature. There's a check-in and bag drop, a new touchless kiosk to allow passengers to check in by scanning a barcode or using voice commands. Health check, passengers would undergo a health screening, as Melody mentioned, have their blood tested. And of course, boarding, passengers would need to be present at the boarding area an hour before departure, maintain social distancing in the gate area, and board only when they receive notifications on their smartphones. I don't know what happens if you don't have a smartphone.
Well, there you go.
But, wow. one of the interesting things too is that they'll take the middle seats out and turn them around. If they want to keep the capacity, they'll just like we see in a lot of Amtrak trains, they'll have the middle seat face the other way with clear barriers between passengers. Think it's tight and you're on the verge of claustrophobia now, Melody?
Well, I wouldn't mind if the middle passenger was facing the other way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I almost like the aisle seat anyway.
More space.
You'd have...
Or at least the perception of it. You'd just be,
maybe
touching each other's legs, but maybe you don't have the shoulder and an armrest issue.
Yeah, I don't know. But you also have, I probably won't fly anymore if they go to all those kind of things. It's like no more flying for me. I'll just have to take an extra week off and drive. We'll have to see more of this country. There's areas of this country I've seen a lot.
We'll start shopping for drivers now, Melody.
Yes. Superintendent of Broward County Public Schools in Florida, they're preparing for a disaster. Earlier this week, Robert Runce, he's the superintendent, as I said, was one of the more than 60 superintendents who sent a letter to Congress warning that big urban school districts could be forced to lay off as many as 275,000 teachers unless the federal government intervenes. Well, Dave,
that's got to be nationwide.
Broward, big urban school districts, yeah. My question is, Broward County is in a pretty wealthy area.
Yeah.
So, hey, do they have property taxes in Florida?
They do.
So, you know, either you cut back, you live within your means, or increase the taxes of those wealthy homes. Increase the sales tax. But, you know, don't run to the federal government. Schools across the country, many are desperate for funds. They're facing an estimated 20% loss in local and state revenues. School districts are already anticipating a difficult year. Then they're scrambling to find ways to pay for these unexpected expenditures. A lot of these buildings have been turned into community feeding hubs. Millions of parents' jobs have been lost. This is a upheaval for kids. The sudden loss of staff could turn a bad situation into a disaster. So this is another area, Dave, where not too many people talk about is the impact turning these schools into feeding hubs. And if you live in an area that you're not impacted, you don't see how some of these areas are being impacted. And I think that's how sometimes we have a tendency to lose a little bit of compassion and a little bit of respect, a little bit of decency, a little bit of common sense. Not to get off on that. So the schools, they're having a hard time, but you know, still, Dave, they need to cut back. You know, if they and this should be a wake up call for a lot of these areas. You know, and it always happens when you're in economic growth. And yes, we've had growth since 2008. People just go wild and think everything is, they just don't plan for that rainy day. Right, Dave? Did I lose you again?
I'm here hanging on your every word.
Did I put you to sleep?
not one bit. You know, can I talk about this? We usually don't go here in these kinds of newsy things. Well, no, it's just something that I'm just so fascinated by this lack of trust between some states and the federal government. Your governor, in fact, Larry Hogan, Maryland's governor,
this is interesting.
Interview saying he's been forced to resort to drastic measures to protect 500,000 test kits from the federal government. You wanted me to go a little further?
I think it's interesting. Scary, but interesting.
The state bought the test kits from South Korea earlier in April, and the state's National Guard is guarding them in a secret location he won't disclose to prevent them from being commandeered by the federal government, by FEMA. Yesterday, Hogan talked about the careful steps he's taking to ensure the tests remain in Maryland. For instance, he had the plane from South Korea land at Baltimore Washington International, or Thurgood Marshall Airport, as it's called now, instead of Washington's Dulles International Airport, to reduce the chances that the feds would seize the cargo. In addition, the plane was greeted by what Hogan described as a large contingent of Maryland National Guard and Maryland State Police. Can you just envision the caravan on I-95?
Yeah.
Presumably, you know, leading and following one or more Mack trucks filled with...
But let me ask you a question, Dave. But who is the ultimate overseer of the Maryland National Guard?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, the governor is, but I believe under, you know, a president can nationalize a state's National Guard. Not 100% of that, but sure of that, but I think they could. I mean, that you raise an interesting question. I can't imagine, I shouldn't say that, because all bets are off these days. We're going nuts.
But we do know that the FEMA did overtake some supplies and so forth from some states, so... anyway, that is a great topic. We'll have to see if we can't figure that, you know, in an emergency type situation. Anyway, we're out of time. We'll be back Monday. Until then, be safe. Good night.